Welcome to the eighth episode of Three Cartoon Avatars. I'm your host, Logan Bartlett, and I'm joined today by my esteemed co-host, the George Costanzo of Venture Capital, Zach Kukoff, and a special guest appearance on the pod, Mr. Not Boring himself, Packy McCormick. How are we doing, guys?
Packy, doing well. First ever guest on the pod.
I really appreciate it. I was feeling left out from Bain Crypto, so to be the fourth white host on this podcast is really
That's
an honor.
Right, yeah. What did we say before we came on? We're two Asian men away from being the Bain Crypto team. Is that right?
Two Asian men and one white man.
Yeah, exactly. So for people listening, Nikita is on a flight, I think, down to Mexico for a vacation this week. So we asked for a pinch hitter. Packy and I have known each other actually at this point, dating back 12 plus years, I think. We were in New York together as young 22-year-olds, bright-eyed and not yet wise to the world. And somehow our paths have collided now into this tech universe. So yeah,
we had some fun. We took party buses down to the beach together.
Logan, I feel like that was your original business. Like,
that was my original startup. Yeah, I would run party buses from New York to the Jersey Shore to the Hamptons on the weekends. Logan would be sitting there either in the house once we got down, or sometimes I think even on the bus on his laptop doing investment banking work.
That's right. So, I feel like I stayed with your family once while we were down there. We had like a beach house that was whatever, like 22-year-olds or 23-year-olds.
It was better than that. It was a two-sided house with one side of the house was 35 girls and the other side of the house was 35 guys. We were so much cooler then.
Yeah, I can't believe we actually did that. Very, very interesting. But Packy, have you ever told the story? I mean, has Throgo ever made an appearance at some point and like how that all led to Not Boring as an entrepreneurial endeavor?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily a straight line led to Not Boring, although it helped me get a job at Breather because our CEO is an iconoclast and didn't want an investment banker, but because I had done some like really shitty startup, I think that helped startup in quotes if you're listening at home. Really shitty thing on the side that helped me get the job. And then, you know, here we are 6 years later and I'm here. The other story we haven't told is that Logan and I also went to Alabama to watch my Tide. It became my Tide that weekend. Just absolutely destroyed the Vols. And I've never seen Logan or maybe anybody as sad as he was sitting in the stands as Alabama just picked Tennessee.
Here I am sitting in like this ridiculous 1996 Tennessee polo after Tennessee had a good first round showing in the March Madness tournament. But I had actually forgotten that. Sometimes on Facebook, that picture will reemerge of us in Alabama, like you and Kirk in like Alabama gear, me in some oversized pants and some Tennessee polo. Well, thank you for joining us. The first guest that we've had. Well, I think the level of you have a observational lens into this weird world that we live in that I think we'll bring in a unique angle here. So thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. I hope not to disappoint. This will be fun.
So the first topic we want to hit this week is AMC, one of the OG meme stocks from a year ago, invested $28 million into Hycroft Mining Holding Corporation, which owns a 71,000 acre mine in Nevada. AMC reports that they are sitting on some 15 million ounces of gold deposits and some 600 million ounces of silver deposits. Their CEO, Adam Aron, characterized the investment as a bold diversification move. He went on to say, our strategic investment being announced today is the result of having identified a company in an unrelated industry that appears to just be like AMC of a year ago. So went on, they got criticized by a bunch of people. Michael Pachter of Wedbush called the move idiotic, specifically pointing to AMC's debt. He said, it's embarrassingly stupid. By that, I don't mean investing in a gold mine is embarrassingly stupid. I mean that it's inappropriate for a movie theater to step so far out of their core business and into something completely unrelated that will not drive any traffic to theaters. Packy, do you have any thoughts on this as as someone very attuned to the meme world of investing?
Matt Levine, in one of the best articles that I've read recently on anything, not just this topic, compared it to kind of like the meme stock final exam. Like 2022 was a lot less fun in the markets. 2021 was so much fun. There are meme stocks everywhere. There are SPACs everywhere. And this has everything. Hycroft was itself a SPAC that had some absurd projections about its silver and gold production that it would have in 2021 and 2022. It's fallen like deeply, deeply, deeply short of that. It actually isn't producing any silver or gold right now. And he also said, he had this great line about Warren Buffett. He said, one way to interpret this is that Adam Aron is the sort of Warren Buffett of meme stocks. Yes, sure, in the sense that he is now apparently building a diversified conglomerate of unrelated businesses. But also, the basic way that Warren Buffett works is when he announces an investment in a stock, that stock goes up. He knows that, and companies know that, and he charges them for it. And I think it's a really funny way of viewing AMC's role. It's never going to work. Like, this falls apart so quickly, but it is funny to view AMC that way.
I'm with you, Packy. I just can't imagine a world where anyone ever looks at this outside of the lens of meme stock investing and thinks it's a smart choice. Like, it just doesn't make any sense for me at all.
Well, I mean, you've said it there, like, outside of the lens of meme stock investing is just not a way that anybody would ever look at this. But I think that Hycroft's stock has already come down. It's still up 250% over the past couple of weeks, I guess, as whispers and their buying started getting out. So it's successful there. There's another piece of this, which apparently is they had a $500 million offering ready to dump on retail as well. And so they're probably unloading some of that. And so they're hoping that the same thing that happens to an AMC happens here, which is a business that was in deep, deep, deep trouble, might actually raise the equity cash that it needs to raise to get out of that trouble. If they pull this off again, maybe there is an actual path where AMC just does this and that's its job, but will be very interesting to see if retail falls for this.
It's pretty funny, this guy, Adam Aron. Like, I was looking up his bio, and he seems like once upon a time, he was a pretty serious dude. Like, he's a co-owner of the Sixers. He was their CEO. Before that, he was the president and CEO of Norwegian Cruise Line. He was the CEO of Vail Resorts. And, like, he's 67 years old, and he went to Harvard, cum laude, like, government major. And to find himself as, like, a strategy leaning into this crypto or this meme stock world as a way of financing like debt and to cover their obligations, I just wonder if he's sitting there being like, what the fuck did I get myself into? Just like rubbing his hand into his eyes, being like, I think there's a path here and it involves leaning into the joke and investing in gold, right? Like, what's actually going through this guy's mind right now?
I think COVID broke a lot of people's brains, and I can't even imagine being in the center of one of these huge meme stock plays. I can't imagine that it doesn't just warp for the rest of your life the way that you view the world, and that any real hard work that he's put in his previous 66 years before this seems kind of silly when you could just sit there and become a meme and make and add billions and billions and billions of dollars to your market cap. So I think it's probably as much that as anything else.
It's more depressing than silly. Like, imagine what it feels like. Imagine, by the way, like, you're starting your career right now, and the options are, do you want to come straight out of college and work really hard and build a traditional career? Or do you want to fuck around and find out and see if you can build a huge business that way? Like, I can't imagine being a fresh grad and not picking option B, fuck around and find out, when you look at the most, well, some of the most at least successful people in the modern economy who have made phenomenal, phenomenal fortunes by fucking around.
Well, you can take the wrong lessons from Elon, too, and be like, look, the richest man in the world is just fucking around on Twitter all day, forgetting that he launched a space company, an electric vehicle company,
totally,
a solar company, and a boring company. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people do take that wrong lesson.
But I think for every Elon, there's 15 Adam Aron, right? Like, how many people are going to say, sure, I'll do the thing of working really hard, launching 5 different companies, and maybe on top, I'll sprinkle in some engagement enthusiasm with the meme world? For some people say, hey, the core of what I'm going to do is be a fun meme, and maybe on top I'll sprinkle in the occasional bout of hard work.
I'm actually kind of surprised there aren't more. Like, this guy's 67 years old. He's kind of an old white man that, you know, went to Harvard from Philly. And I'm surprised. And then there's Elon on the other end of this extreme, who's this South African multi-company entrepreneur founder. And clearly they're both leaning into jokes in very different ways, right? But there aren't that many founders in between, really. Like, there isn't a $4 or $5 billion public software company that I know of that's out there just like trolling with their stock or whatever. It's sort of like there's one Elon and then there's a handful of like random people at the edges. And so I wonder if there's going to be like more and more of these people that are embracing the shtick and leaning into this. And I'm kind of surprised there haven't been to date.
we know that there's an incredible amount of institutional pressure that gets put on you the closer you get to becoming a public company CEO. So the idea that anybody who is serious enough to start and grow a business could also be the right kind of weird to actually go out and run a meme stock or go out and actually run a meme engagement, it's sort of like threading a very small needle of people. I actually don't know if it's even structurally possible to get there.
I mean, look at your Twitter kind of before and after going to a larger fund, right? Like, you got way less fun.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you're looking to do this.
That's exactly, Zach. You know, Zach went one way. I went the other. I went from a firm in which I had more constraints to one that liberated my ability to post on Twitter a little bit. And I will say, one of my partners gives me a hard time. He blames me for like breaking 10 VCs' brains. And now there's like all these shitty versions of like meme posters out there in VC. And he's always like, this is your fault. He'll send me some terrible joke that someone's making. And he's like, I actually personally blame you for this. And it's a pretty running bit internally.
Who do you think is the worst at this?
The worst at posting on Twitter?
Yeah, like the worst at playing the Logan game.
The Logan game. Yeah, I'm glad. I want to embrace that specifically. I would say initially the one that we've talked about in the past that just sort of willed their way into it, obviously, was Mark Andreessen, that sort of was out there. And it seemed like went from not posting at all to like discovering what a meme was. But the guy's obviously very bright. And so his feedback loop and how he iterated on it, like the progress he made in a very short time, he started with this very raw MVP of ship posting. And then like he took feedback and actually built up. And so now it's actually far more entertaining. When we started this podcast 8 weeks ago or whatever, it was at the like peak of cringe. We could probably come up with some like, you know, slope of enlightenment or some Gartner like rise of where it was. But he's actually gotten to be a decent follow with good entertainment.
I actually would argue that even peak cringe Mark was pretty good. Like if Packy Jilly asking who are the worst of the worst,
yeah,
like even in Mark's trough of disillusionment, right, I would still take Mark posting over like 80% of the VCs who we know, even with the help of ghostwriters, are still not as funny. I'll put it this way. They're not. I don't feel like they're as funny as me post joining a regulated group, let alone Logan, who's in the wild west of like shooting from the hip.
I think the fun thing about Mark's tweeting was, you know, Jack came out in that battle and was just having more fun clearly doing it than anybody on the A16Z side. And then it looks like they're just like, wait, we could just have fun and win this thing. And then Mark has just had as much fun as humanly possible on Twitter for the past couple of
weeks. It's amazing. I mean, it's honestly, it's amazing you get to that point where you just really don't care what anyone thinks. And the weird feeling that these people have with millions of followers, just that they put something out and the number of people that have notifications like are instantly engaging with it. It must be such a weird hit of dopamine to your brain.
Yeah.
Like, to have this and then instantly like Elon posts something and every single thing he posts have hundreds of thousands of likes and like instant engagement. I just think how weird that must feel as a thing. And so I actually like that Andreessen's like having a good time, you know, messing around. Now, I think at times he walks the line of bully, which I've certainly been accused of as well. But I think he has a much bigger pulpit and more influence than I do in that regard. And so at times I feel like antagonizing some of these founders isn't the best look, but yeah.
I mean, we know that he's having a good time. I will say we're going to talk about Glossier later, but did you guys see what he posted about Glossier, where he posted a screenshot of his shopping cart adding a bunch of stuff after the article came out? Like, that's
I love that.
Andreessen, right, that's what I love. I love that kind of Andreessen posting. Like, there's a way to do it that I think doesn't feel like bullying, right? There's a way to do it to use the bully pulpit that's supportive. And certainly we all missed the mark on that, but hopefully your brain isn't broken enough by the constant dopamine hit of having thousands of people simping for you in your replies that you don't forget how to be positive.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can speak as someone who has like three or so times as many followers as Logan. It's a real kind of constant dopamine.
Did you see how subtle Packy worked that in? He's like, as someone who's actually far more popular than Logan Bartlett myself, I can tell you my brain isn't nearly as broken as his.
Packy, I can only imagine. I mean, you've had quite a glow up here, though. I can only imagine the early days of shouting into the void here now 2 years later. I mean, what was your Twitter follower account, whatever, 2 years ago? Was it, did you have a couple thousand?
So when I started like writing and I did per my last email first, when I started doing that, I think I had like 300 followers and I tweeted about like the Eagles and stuff like that. And then it took a year and maybe I got to like 500 followers. And then I started doing Not Boring full time. And then it's kind of grown. But it does get weirder, right? Like, you know, everybody always says that over 10,000 is where it shifts. And for me, and you'll learn this one day, maybe over 100,000 is where it really felt like it shifted in a pretty big way.
What was the shift? Like, what broke your brain? I mean, I know obviously you're not the same person. You know, your ego is so big, and your head and all this stuff as you were.
A lot of brain padding.
Yeah. Just is it everyone gassing you up every time you post something, or what?
It's not that as much. The thing that I think is tough is that things leave your like circle of people who know you, more quickly. And so like the one that actually broke my brain, because there was like. It was a very weird one where I made a joke about Apple or Shopify being worth more than Apple just based on like their share prices, and the amount of people who got on there and called me an idiot for not understanding the difference between a share price and a market cap, and like just little things like that.
Yeah.
Where I know the difference between those things, and it still kind of felt weird and hurt a little bit. That was the one where I was like, wow, this can get really weird.
I've had a couple of those. I had one where I tweeted something about superhuman. Remember the controversy a couple of years ago over the superhuman email location tracking?
Yeah.
I tweeted something to the effect of like, you know, every marketing tool you've ever been exposed to is exposing your location. Superhuman's not the problem here. Something like very mild to that effect. I had people sending me like death threats over that one. That was like the worst the context bubble's ever been broken. And then the other harmless side, it's like I did the dumb tweet about, you know, Jeff Bezos can give every American $1 billion or whatever, some like dumb thing like that. And that way had a lot of people, a lot of math explainers coming into my mentions hoping to teach me basic arithmetic.
I know part of it is like the personal thing where you're like, no, that's not what I meant. And part of it is like you weep for humanity a little bit, that like there's so many people out there who, one, both don't get the joke, but then like two are big enough assholes to feel the need to like tell you how wrong you are. It does make you a little bit sad about humanity.
I always really enjoy that, though. Like the circle of when you get to a certain amount of followers, that there's a circle of people that are in on the joke and like it. And then you feel it when it's escaped that cocoon. And like, you know, I remember I posted an email there, I think on the same day Airbnb and DoorDash went public. And I posted a fake email that I was passing on both of the CEOs at the same time. Right. And I was like, listen, my G5 Wi-Fi is cutting out. And like, so I just figured I would consolidate the pass emails. And then I tweeted out like, so proud to have been there from the early days or something. And it started and you could see it. It was like starting to get there and you could tell it was kind of taken off. And I knew it was going to hit some escape velocity in which people were going to get very upset about it. And so I leaned into the joke and then I got people, this is very meta, but then I had people upset that I wasn't correcting people and like, embracing fake information and stupidity on the internet, right? And it's just like all these things end up being very meta and navel-gazy.
You had one of those about this even podcast where I saw that happen. You tweeted something that was like obviously a fake text between you and a drizzly delivery person, you know, offering to give your autograph as a host of the pod. Remember, like I saw that in my timeline a couple times. People kept engaging with it earnestly. And I'm like, how? Like, I could not believe someone read that and thought, well, maybe Logan's ego is so big that he does think the drizzly guy is
honestly
going to get my autograph.
Mean, everyone thinks it's like, you know, life of a podcaster is just like women being thrown at you and, you know, parties all the time and all that. And I get how you could be confused about the autographs that people would want from you as like, you know, as a very modestly successful podcaster. But I've thankfully been able to keep my, you know, roots about me.
Yeah, it's funny. It's us, the Red Scare girls and the Cumtown boys who just constantly are being chased by people everywhere we go.
Are you not the Cumtown boys?
Oh, yeah. Did you not realize? We actually are part of the shit, the dirtbag left as well. People always forget that about us.
Roseanne Winsack, who has been a longtime friend of mine, and we've collaborated on a number of deals over the years. She was a partner at IVP for a number of years and now has recently started her own fund, Renegade Partners. Roseanne, do you want to give a quick intro?
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me. I've known Logan. I know we used to hang out a lot more when he was like bugging me to mark up his deals. Doesn't do that too much these days.
That's what Tiger.
Really? No, now you should be marking up mine because we like switched.
I know.
But I was previously at IVP. I'm one of the two founders of Renegade Partners, an early stage venture firm.
And Roseanne sat on the board of Glossier for 4 years?
We invested like September of 2016, and I left at the beginning of 2019.
Got it. And Roseanne, how big do you have to get in terms of AUM to be a target of your very own hit piece?
I don't know. If you guys could find out for me, like, that would be great.
Hopefully we'll get some some contributions from people weighing in on, like, when they're really chomping at the bit
to take me down.
Yeah. As much fun as we thought, three straight white men weighing in on the issues of female founders being written about hit pieces, we thought it made sense to have someone else with a little more credibility on the subject join us here. So, Roseanne, thanks for coming on.
Oh, wow. You have a whole fancy setup for the mic there, too.
I do. I don't know how much you guys can see, but I joke that this is like my OnlyFans setup because I like the light on the ring.
Okay. That's great.
And also, we just added a woman to the team here faster than Bain did, I have to say.
That's going to get in trouble. You can't make that joke.
No. Listen, last week, just for a little inside baseball, last week we had a bit. Lydia Helton had already joined Bain Crypto from our team. And so we were talking about it last week. I knew she had joined. And so we had this like extra 3 minutes of the pod sort of talking about her joining and me being like, guys, why didn't you just wait a fucking week to announce her joining, right? And then I realized we were going to run it before she actually joined. And so I didn't want to like front run her announcement. And so we had to cut it. But Lost to the Archives is one of our former employees joining Bain Crypto. So good. Well, let's dive in. Well, Roseanne, thank you for joining us. I think one of the things that we wanted to get your insider take on was an article from Business Insider this week, and it was about a company in which you were formerly invested and formerly on the board, entitled How Glossier Founder Emily Weiss's Tech Dreams Derailed the Hottest Millennial Beauty Brand. So I'll read a little bit here for people that didn't have a chance to read it, and we'll link in the show notes. But they went through and said Glossier is valued at $1.8 billion. Financial success belied a sometimes chaotic, unstable work environment, according to 17 former employees who as recently as January worked at Glossier's New York headquarters. They describe a founder who sometimes overvalued employees' social media clout. Editors note on this, like, social media is pretty important, obviously. So I mean, if it's Twitter followers, then I think I'm on board. But an appearance and whose years-long obsession with transforming the beauty brand into a tech company sparked internal tensions. New hires from Facebook and Amazon clashed with veteran employees, while Weiss's nebulous vision for an in-house social e-commerce platform led to stalled progress and wasted resources, they said. So they kind of went through the whole thing. I guess this is a little bit of a recurring trope at this point that female founders get these takedown pieces that ultimately get run about their business. And it feels like something that seems to happen too often. So Roseanne, would love to get your take about how media covers female founders in general or Glossier specifically.
Yeah, no, I'd rather talk in general. I mean, I just think, I don't know, I tweeted about it yesterday, but like, I didn't want to like retweet it or give it like any additional, like that addition, like article, any additional pull or reach. Not that I have like followings like you guys, right? I am like, you know, hanging out like 3,000 Twitter followers.
You missed a long bit of us all navel gazing about our Twitter followers. So that's actually going to work in very nicely.
I don't know who this we all. You missed Packy navel gazing about his Twitter followers. Man comes on 1 minute and he's like, oh, by the way, I have a fuck ton more followers than the rest of you have combined. So you all get fucked on your pod.
Packy McCormick, 50x of Roseanne Twitter followers. Yes.
Wow. That's actually very true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Packy's first, like, I call you like 50x.
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
So 50x Packy from now on.
Yeah, exactly. We'll do an intro.
10x engineers, 50x Packies. We'll start a Twitter controversy.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like this trope is just so, how is this even news, right? Like, all of this stuff, like, there are always female takedowns. There are always female founder takedowns. Like, yes, there have been male founder takedowns, but they have to do with, like, generally, like, fraud, right? Or, you know, when there's, like, real bad things happening. I feel like these female takedowns are just about, like, oh, like, disgruntled or, like, former employees that are no longer with the company speaking on the record anonymously. Like, how is that news? And, like, people are trying to do hard things and it's hard and not all of them work. Like, what do you want somebody to do? Like,
yeah. And when we talk about the list of the recurring nature of this, so I compiled a little list here and all of them are different, right? But it is, I mean, as a percentage of negative stories that get covered about founders, it's definitely disproportionate. And so the ones that I came up with, Theranos is obviously kind of its own beast, but then Away, the luggage company, The Wing, Outdoor Voices, Modern Health, Spring Health, Museum of Ice Cream. So it's honestly, I mean, it's probably a smaller fraction of female founders that haven't had a takedown piece written about them at this point.
But it feels like you could write something about any founder, right? Because Roseanne, to your point, like every startup is hard to build. We all know that. Like every startup is going to have cultural rough patches. So the head scratcher is like, if you assume that every startup could have a piece written like this, the motivation to go after only female CEOs or predominantly female CEOs, it makes it feel far more malicious.
I mean, I think it just like sounds like more salacious. And what's so funny to me about all of these is that like, they always bring up like pettiness and cattiness. And I'm like, this article is just pure pettiness and cattiness, like pot and kettle. Like, what the hell, right? Like, it's like, this is like what you're complaining about. And and this is your medium, right? It's like, it's just so ridiculous to me. And actually, I remember like when Away happened, like I had two of my male CEOs text me and be like, shit, I've written slacks like that.
Of course.
Or CTO until there's no longer a ticket backlog. And they were like, is somebody going to publish this? And I'm like, no, don't worry. Right. Like, you're a dude. But I don't understand like why. Like, I don't know. I don't understand, why people also think it's an interesting story.
The Spring Health one was the least interesting ever to me. Like, you know, like, at least there were fired employees and some of the other ones. And the Spring Health one, it was really kind of just, like, the CEO and the marketing person were, like, kind of pushing back and forth on what the marketing goal should be. And, like, he wanted to sandbag it, and she wanted it to be more aggressive, which is, I think, has never not happened between a CEO and a head of marketing in the history of companies. And that was, like, the core piece there, and like that his team had worked hard then because of that. Like, there was nothing in that one that was absurd. But I mean, the Away one, my brother actually was at Away when that one happened. He was totally team Steph in that whole kind of situation, because he's like, look, the people who got fired, many of them got fired for a reason, because they were like attacking other employees. The CS lead who got, you know, who was kind of upset in the story, wasn't hitting his numbers at all. Like, there's very clear metrics. Like, there's all this stuff that happens that obviously doesn't get reported on. And then the story is like, this female founder is, you know, out of control. And it just is wild that story keeps happening.
So in full disclosure, I've known Steph for probably as longer than I've known Packy. And so this is dating back, whatever, 12 years, and was actually an investor in a way. And so, I mean, she's a friend of mine. And as all this stuff was going on, it's ridiculous. The same terms that get used for men, like, get flipped on their head for women. And I don't think it's just reporters doing it. If you go read Glassdoor, I think some of the terms that employees will also use, like about the female leader, it's like a male will be irreverent versus a female will be vulgar, right? Like a male will be introverted. A female will be standoffish. Like, one will be hard charging, the other will be like a psycho, right? And it's like all these things that are just veiled in more negative sentiment and how people talk. And then these are coming from somewhere, right? There's like kind of a formula that exists. It feels like there's a bunch of focus on the rise. I feel like in general, society only wants to hear the rise and the fall. Like, those are the only stories that exist. It's like you build someone up and you take someone down and then you build someone up again. And that's true of Tiger Woods, it's true of Kanye West, it's true of, you know, whoever, right? Lance Armstrong. And so I feel like the way these narratives play out is like, build up expectations, wait for company to hit speed bumps, like find former employees, get them to talk, and like, particularly if they're recently laid off, and then like the culture gets compared to Mean Girls, and then you magnify like normal business things, like put a microscope on it and take it out of context, right? And like all of them sort of follow that same formula in some way.
Yeah. And like, I just don't understand how that's like interesting or compelling anymore. Right. And I think a big part of it too, is that like in that rise, I kind of got into it with somebody on Twitter about this morning, like, you know, it's like, oh, when people get all this attention on the rise, it's like, it's because they're made out to be these like perfect, like godlike humans. And then it's like, no, they're just people and they're flawed. Like we're all flawed, right? Like we all have ups and downs and like, this is all hard. And, but I think like, it's like, you can't have one without the other, right? Like you need to have that like hype cycle to like get these people up there. Cause otherwise it's not interesting to tear them down if nobody knows who they are.
Roseanne, specifically about Glossier, like Emily Weiss had this very polished image, right? And to some extent, she represented so many idealistic, even the article, it sounds like, you know, employees treated her in this messianic kind of way, right? And they just so looked up, they followed into the gloss all the way through. And so is it somewhat that these reporters want to report on any deviation from like the narrative? Or is it just that, is it like that, hey, it's not as perfect as it seems and they want to poke it in some way? Or do you have any perspective on that?
No, I mean, I think a lot of this is that like when the press kind of presents like any of these people, like any of these leaders to, you know, like, you know, publicly, it's like everything is perfect about them, right? Like they have these like perfect homes and perfect lives and, you know, perfect partners and children and families and all of these things, right? And so it's, you know, it just kind of like, I think it just opens the door for all of these like pokes and holes. And I think that, I mean, I just like would think, I think when you like interview, right? Like, I mean, packing your earlier points about like away, right? Like when you interview former staff or people who aren't, you know, who aren't performing at their jobs at like anonymously, right? Like they can say whatever they want because it's not going to be tied back to them. Like, you know, those, to me, those are just cheap shots.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is not a point about any of these companies specifically, but more generally, like the one thing I will say is startups, we all know, use vision so much to hire that when you sell a bunch of 22-year-old fresh grads on changing the world and convince them that they're going to be making a major impact, and it doesn't matter what the company actually does, right? But that's the pitch you've given them. Whenever you ultimately come back to them and have anything that goes off the rails culturally, an employee who underperforms, whatever the normal speed bumps that we know companies face are, it becomes magnified because the expectation has been set so high. So this is not about Glossier or any company in particular, but like we know, certainly in Logan and I and Roseanne and all of our portfolios, like we know folks use the lure of vision to get people to come work for them versus going and collecting a check at Fang.
I mean, I think it's not only like, yes, people sell vision, and also like entrepreneurs as a class of humans like have to be compelling and have to be people that, you know, others want to follow. But also, you know, when you are hiring a bunch of 22-year-olds and they've never had a, like, this is their first or maybe second jobs, like if you think about like, oh, what's my worst job experience in this, or like, you know, what's my job experience and this is 150% of it, right? Like everything feels like a big deal.
Yeah.
Right. And you become like old person like me, and like you just kind of start rolling with the punches because you realize like this shit happens all the time. Right.
That's what I think is so interesting about these things is like what they're reporting on. For the most part, it's like normal business stuff that you could talk about any company. And so it always sounds very just like an alien has dropped into startup culture. And it's like everything that gets reported makes it sound like it's this sensational thing. But I feel like the reporters are just so outside of like how startups actually run. And to some extent, I don't know. I mean, I got such a kick out of some of the stuff they reported on in this. But like, for example, they went on like a full paragraph about how clean a desk needed to be. Or they spoke for a while about, I'll just read the excerpt. Inside a sprawling executive conference room that Weiss often worked from, a round show-stopping fish tank that bulged out from the wall often sat empty. I think it had fish in it for a short period of time before they were taken out or died, a former employee said, adding that the tank had water filtration issues. Sometimes a paper insert from a photo of marine life was placed instead. And it's like, what?
Who cares?
Are we talking about?
And half the time, that was a funny joke that somebody in the office played and like put up a picture of a fish. It wasn't like an evil corporate thing.
Yeah, I was like, you know what? Let's kill the fish and then let's put like some art of fish. To remind everybody.
Do you think, are they like trying to build a metaphor of like, you know, like, is this supposed to be something that they tie back of like life is, you know, startup life is short and fish don't survive and neither might startups or is it just
there's something fishy going on at Glossier?
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's just like, I think, Logan, I think your first point is like spot on. It's like, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, these people, they use Slack and they'll email after 5 p.m. And oh my God, that's a startup, right? Like, I think it's like, or it's like, oh, there's a, like, there are tons of companies that make you have your desk be clean.
Of course.
Right? Or that won't, like, talk on your desk. Like, it's not like that's new or been, in, like, introduced everywhere. There's plenty of companies that, like, had fish tanks that don't have fish in them anymore. But there are lots of fish tanks in the world that no longer have fish. Like, how is that newsworthy?
But this is the problem, right? If you're, if your job is to go out and find sensationalistic stories, and Packy, as the only quasi-journalist here, I'd be curious to get your take. But, like, if your job is to go out and find sensationalistic stories and you tweet every morning, I'm eager to hear from X employees of company Y or company Z, right? And all you get are comments from employees who have left this company voluntarily or otherwise, of course you're going to only hear ridiculous shit. You're not talking to people who are happy. And we know the silent majority of these employees are probably perfectly content in their jobs, not going and talking to folks who are reaching out to them on Twitter.
Or I'm sure they're getting reached out to by people who are happy or have good things to say, but that's just boring.
I don't even know if they are. I actually don't even know if they are.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm sure in their reach outs, they like get some people who are positive.
I'd be curious to think, like, if you tweeted, if you're a reporter and you tweet, I want to hear from X employees of company Y about crazy stories, right? Or how is your experience working? The kind of person who's motivated to reach out, I have to imagine it's like 90-10 negative positive.
And it's also what I would imagine happens is there's probably a group chat of those former employees going on where they're like, hey, this person reached out. Are you going to talk? And so I do think there's like kind of that social kind of reinforcement that happens where like the group of people who are negative and fired and have nothing to lose all tell each other that they're going to go on. And then people who are there and happy are like, I'm not going to risk my job that I like.
Yeah.
Talk to Insider about their 17th female hit piece in a row, which it's like, the last two were Insider. I don't know how many of those on the list are Insider pieces. They've also, I think, found a formula here. And like the really cynical view of this is not just like the takedown of the woman piece sells, because, you know, that's kind of on all of us. We read these pieces and they write what we read. But the other thing is, I think there's a meta point now where they know that they're going to get everybody pissed off. And that Glossier article had 100 times more readers than if it weren't a hit piece on a female CEO for the 50th time in a row, because everybody's talking about that point. And so everybody's reading it now.
I hate to talk about the business incentive, but think about the incentive for the reporter too, right? I'm going to write my hit piece on company X. I'll sell my book proposal about company X if they're influential enough. I'll get my Brian Koppelman Showtime show about company X, right? And maybe, God willing, I'll win an Oscar. Like, that's the, or whatever, an Emmy. Like, I don't know that that's necessarily what's at play in this specific story, but, like, there certainly is a pipeline of negative coverage to book proposal to television that we've seen play out.
Out of the gloss.
Yeah, exactly. Don't give people shortcuts of how to come up with stuff here. Honestly, this is the way I feel about social media in general, but media especially, is like, it's actually a reflection of us and of society in so many ways. And so the reason that there are these it's like so self-fulfilling, right? And we're talking about it now. And Roseanne, you did a good job of like not sharing the thing, but it's totally circular and it compounds on itself of like, they wouldn't keep doing these if they didn't keep getting attention, if it wasn't good for the business, right? And so that's why I always feel like I'm a Facebook defender, because I'm like, well, maybe humanity wasn't meant to connect all the weirdos together, right? And like, maybe that's on humanity. And I realized Facebook should do a better job of like trying to constrict flow of information and all that. But I was like, we need to acknowledge that there are like a lot of fucking freaks that exist in the world, and like connecting them with other freaks isn't going to lead to good outcomes. Right. And so I think these are all kind of go back to business incentives.
It's that. And there's also like, there's algorithms that like are fairly easy to like, it kills me now. And I've tweeted about it recently. Like, it kills me now that it is so easy to say, here's 10 anything colon on Twitter, and then do a thread on it, and it's going to get thousands and thousands of likes. And there's a disappointing amount of humans who are like just down to go play into that format in order to grow. And so I think like as there's like some relationship between how easy it is to figure out the algorithm and then like just how many people are going to go do what the algorithm says, no matter what that thing is, which I think probably is a play. There's like some meta algorithm at play with the Insider pieces here too.
Well, I think social media is like such a great, like, it's like a perfect reflection of like our brains, right? Because like, basically like the things that get us riled up are all the stuff that like hits our amygdala, right? Our like little animal brain that only knows how to be angry, like doesn't have any critical thought. Like, it loves to get stuff like really like that's like short and fast, right? And like just piss you off, right? And that's like that's what's engaging, right? So it's just like, I don't know, I feel like it's such a, like, yes, a reflection of humanity to your point, Logan, but also just like a reflection of like, yeah, our brains are not ready for, like, are not, have not evolved to this. And basically it's just like an anger engine.
Yeah. Nuance gets lost in everything here, but the insider is just waiting, chomping at the bit to take down some female influencer. So Roseanne, I hope you can get there. Yeah. Just so they can continue to drive clicks.
That's why I keep my Twitter follower count low, so that, you know,
that's cancellation.
That's going to bring me down. Nobody cares.
You have to get through a certain point pretty quick, because you run the risk in the, like, some thousand or like some thousands of followers. You really run the risk of being canceled. But then you get to the, you know, some point that you can just power through it. Right. And people forget. So, Roseanne, anything else that you want to hit on this? Like, any points you want to convey that we didn't sort of get to?
I don't know. I mean, actually, guys, like, you, like, warmed my heart today, because, you know, this conversation is like the conversation that, like, the groups, like, groups of women are having all the time. And, the, like, hearing you guys say it.
Oh, that's good. Warm. Yeah.
Let's definitely calling us the best male feminists in the world in the clip this week. That's like, let's make sure we keep that just in circulation, please.
I have my pink hat over here that I'm on it. Yeah.
All through. Born white guy host, but, like, really good.
Really good. We're some of the good ones, Packy. Don't worry.
not all men.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually my brand, is not like other VCs, but also not like the other men. You know, I'm like, I'm just different than that. So another thing we wanted to hit this week were Google employees. CNBC had an article about Google employees are becoming unhappy with pay, promotion, and execution, survey results show. So Google's annual employee survey came out called Googlegeist. And it showed that a growing number of staffers don't view their pay packages as fair or competitive with what they could make in a similar role elsewhere. They're also questioning their employer's ability to execute. The surveys were taken in January and released to employees last week. CNBC reviewed the results from the company overall, as well as individual groups. In addition to this, Google is about to bring most of their employees back into the office. The numbers here briefly, only 46% of survey respondents said their compensation is competitive compared to similar jobs at other companies. That was down 12% from a year earlier. And 56% said their pay is fair and equitable, which was a drop of 8% from the year prior. So I will say something in this in general is, so I think you guys know, we have a TikTok presence as well. And we made a joke about Google engineers being privileged in their pay packages and their benefits and all that. And I'll tell you, that is a group that will get very riled up. We kicked the hornet's nest and we got a lot of comments back from people. It was very angry. So do you guys have any opinions on this on Google?
Who are the 50% of people at Google who think they can make more money for working 3 hours a day somewhere else? Like, I love my Google friends. I really do. But, like, one of my Google buddies who now has since left and is a founder, when he was a PM at Google, he was rolling in around 10:30, 11, getting in a quick workout and breakfast, doing maybe 2 or 3 hours of work, right? Getting a haircut on campus or doing laundry or whatever, and then leaving by like 4 to beat traffic. What is the job that pays you like mid 6 figures to work 4 hours a day somewhere else? And can we all have that job? Because I would love to find out what it is.
I was going to say, I mean, like, the thing doing the most work in all of this was the similar role elsewhere. Nobody else has a similar role to what Google does. I was talking to somebody a couple weeks ago, and this is not like revolutionary, but it was like, by far the company that could slash the highest percentage of its employee base and not see a single bit of hit to the business is Google. Like, that you could probably cut Google down to what, 500 employees and probably even less, and retain like 98% of the performance of the business. So it's just like very funny that they have all these people kind of hanging out doing nothing at Google and there's complaining about it.
There's probably a direct correlation between like amount of internal company drama and employee free time. Like, if your employees have so much time, they can get into like message wars on the internal message board, they probably aren't working as hard as they could somewhere else.
That's always my favorite trope, by the way. There's always videos about like boomer worker talking to young worker. And it's like, hey, I think I'm going to take this weekend off because I'm going to drop dead. And then the like young employees, like, so I think a VP title is probably commiserate with my work. And I'm just wondering after 3 or 6 months, what's your promotion cycle, right?
Yeah. By the way, Logan, to your point, do you guys remember that Twitter thread that was going around of the guy who interviewed the startup founder who interviewed the kid? And he was like, the like 22-year-old asked him for a board seat as part of the negotiation for an IC role.
Yes. I honestly, you have to shoot your shot with that stuff. I think if someone came in to me and said like, hey, you know, I would like to own half the LP relationships, I'd be like, well, it's an interesting ask. I mean, no, obviously, but it's an interesting, I respect the ask, right?
You gotta Logan's shoot your future shot. Analysts are going to be like, I actually want to be on management committee. So how do we make that happen? Like, yeah, I really exactly. would like to be part of the management company now.
Is it a 2 or 3 year path to investment committee on this? You know, it's interesting, though. I mean, one of the things that was kind of buried in all of this is that Google is bringing people back to work in person, right? And I do think that's going to be particularly interesting. I was talking to a recruiter recently, and they were saying, you know, a lot of people, not only have people joined into remote work, right, over the course of the last, whatever, 2 years, but there's actually a lot of people that have entered the workforce having never been a part of office culture at all, right? And so for us, it's like, hey, this distanced thing that we totally. Remember and we remember all the benefits and trade-offs. But like, it's interesting of getting people to actually go back into the office. It's going to be funny to see how lavish the perks are that they have to like, you know, the foosball doesn't really work as like the only thing you can use anymore. It's going to need to be, I mean, I don't know where Google could take it to, but they have massages back when in-office culture was like a normal thing. Like, what are they going to need to do to get these employees back in office now?
I think that's one way of looking at it. I think the flip side is if you're starting your career remote, how lonely must that be? Like, if I was starting my career in a remote work sense, I would be desperate. In fact, I am desperate to go back to an office every day because I would miss or I would crave the ability to talk to other people who do this job or do my job in a relative way.
I'm laughing, like craving human touch. Like I would crave, you know, I just want to be around humans. Honestly, the remote work absolutists, it's such an interesting thing. Talk about another like hornet's nest to kick. But we've walked into that before. And there's so many people that I got notes when we talked about remote work that someone said, love the pod, but you have no idea what the fuck you're talking about with remote work. And I was like, oh, interesting. I mean, there's a lot of things I don't know what I'm talking about, but like, I, you know, I'm a man with a microphone, so obviously I deserve a podcast, right? And so it's just so funny how angry yeah. people, of all the topics I've gotten like backlash on, remote work and then Google like culture are the two that I've gotten people by far the most angry at me.
I get the most toxic takes about remote work. I had a tweet on viral where I tweeted something along the lines of, if you're a fresh grad coming out of undergrad and you're starting your career remotely, you're probably taking a career hit if you work remote versus working in person. And the amount of, first of all, the amount of 22-year-olds, to my point a second ago, who DM'd me privately and were like, yeah, I'm feeling the work hit, was astronomical. The amount of people who were like posturing for likes in my replies by talking about, you know, I'm an evil person for thinking we'll have to go into the office every day. It was insane. I couldn't believe the backlash. And then I couldn't believe the gap between the people who were actually living this, who were craving the ability to go in office and be mentored and have a cohort of folks around them, versus the folks who were, you know, like it's like a religion, who had taken religion on working remote and now wanted to push for it.
I think in both remote and Google too, there's probably the segment of people who are like, yo, shut the fuck up, don't ruin this for us. Because like some people are super, super happy. And that's probably, you know, older people, certainly like me, I have my kid here. This is great.
No one likes to feel the virtues of remote work more than like comfortable 36-year-olds or 38-year-olds,
totally.
Like making 500K or whatever a year, right? Meanwhile, these 22-year-olds are like living in New York with 5 roommates and they're jammed into shoebox apartment and like, you know, they can hear each other through the fake walls they've put up. And
yeah.
We crave human contact.
I'm desperate to get into the office and not be in my like triple subdivided living room situation with me and my like one shitty fake house plant that I'm trying to keep alive.
Thank you so much for joining the 8th episode of 3 Cartoon Avatars. A special thanks to Roseanne for coming on, as well as Packy for filling in for Nikita today.
That was a lot of fun. I do this anytime.
Yeah, well, that's good. We've already told Nikita that he's gone.
Perfect. So Zach and I will be back next week with either Packy or someone else we bring in. So listen in for the ninth episode. Appreciate everyone joining.